welcome back to Potbreak Saturday Morning Adventures, where contributors to thepotbreak.com and their friends kick back, tune in, and zone out to the kids' cartoons that define their childhoods and the ones that still give them life to this day. My name is Alex Marcus, podcasting director of thepotbreak.com, and today, as we have been for the last 7 weeks, I am here to discuss X-Men 97 with my good friend Kay Anderson of the Lost Spaces podcast. How are you today, Kay?
Hello. I'm okay. I'm good. No, I'm yes, I'm all of those things. I'm good.
I know we were a little bit, you were, I think, even more so than me down on last week's episode. So I just want to like start out up top. Where is your energy level at with episode 7?
Well, first of all, I don't remember you being down on last week's episode. Or was it just that you were like trying to counterbalance my negativity and maybe you tipped too far into the other way? Okay.
I think it was more that, yeah.
So my energy on this week's episode is okay. I feel like a lot did happen, but I also feel like it's like an episode in the middle of the season that's leading up to lots of other things. So it felt a bit like we were treading water a bit.
Yes, that was sort of what my feeling was too, right? We've got a lot of episodes early in this season, and even in the middle of the season, that really felt like self-contained stories, right? And now we are very much in the sort of building the season-long plot to the climax that we are headed towards, right? We know the next 3 weeks are the final three episodes. It's a three-parter, part one, part two, part three. I was kind of hoping that that episode 7 would be one more kind of self-contained story, you know, even if it meant, I really thought with it being called Bright Eyes and everything else, I thought that we might have just a point of view episode about Cable. Like, what was Cable up to? Why was he just like popping up in that one moment with Madeline? What was he doing when all this other stuff was happening? That was my theory, and I was really looking forward to that. No one told me that was going to happen, and it didn't happen. So that's on me. Setting false expectations.
Oh, because didn't we talk about Bright Eyes being about Cyclops? Was that
just that was what your theory. You thought it would be about Cyclops.
It was about neither of them.
Nope, it was about a guy who turns into a robot. So
yeah, I hate when that happens. Yeah,
I know. It's such a shame. It's like, I can't even tell you how many dates went south as soon as he turned into a robot. But in any case.
Well, this is the lesson here. Never throw him out of the window at the end.
It's true.
Don't throw him off a building.
It only took me 2 times to learn that lesson. So, you know. But yeah, we're alluding to something obviously that happened in the episode. This is, if we had to say what like the main character of this episode is, I would say, even though it was a pretty ensemble heavy episode, I'd say it would be Rogue, right? This really feels like we're centered on Rogue and her grief. This episode is only a couple of days old, but a lot of memes kind of came out of this episode around the fact that she seems way more upset about Gambit than Magneto, even though just a day earlier she was really locked in an intense love triangle between the two of them. Now part of it is probably because as an audience we're more upset that Gambit is dead. Also, you know, the show knows that Magneto isn't really dead, so maybe putting too much emphasis on that would feel cheap, if only to then reveal that he's actually alive. But what do you make of that choice?
Well, I mean, so maybe Rogue is a bit like us and she knows that she hasn't seen Magneto's body. So maybe he's not dead. Like that's what I'm thinking. But also, I think, you know, the human response to all of this is that she had been neglecting her relationship with Gambit, had finally gotten to a point where she was like, no, he is the one that I want to be with. And then he went ahead and died. So there's kind of like this guilt wrapped into it as well, which could mean that she then leans more towards being upset about him than about Magneto. But also, like, you know, Magneto is getting on in years. He's going to die soon anyway.
It's true. That was kind of built in to her interest in him, right? But yeah. And there's also the piece of it where Gambit more directly, like, sacrifices himself for her, right? Magneto does kind of push her away to try to keep her out of harm's way a little bit, but really once it seems like Magneto has died in that episode, Rogue goes headlong straight into the robot and it's Gambit who prevents her from killing herself and then takes that bullet for her. So I could see the guilt being stronger on that. as well.
I don't think she would have killed herself, though. She's a superhuman being. Why is everyone trying to, like, protect her? She's got better powers than all of them.
Well, it was a robot that was just, like, disintegrating everyone. I don't think that she stood much of a chance.
She would have been fine. Anyway, that's just my opinion.
She took on some robots in this episode and was not that fine. So, you know, it's they kind of make a note of how even though she is as powerful as she is, she got taken out with one hit when our brand new Prime Sentinel made its debut. But that's too late in the episode. Let's stay focused on the start of the episode for a few minutes.
Yes, 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 yes.
We start out, it's Gambit's funeral, RIP. Our friends from last week, Professor X and Storm, have not yet arrived. They are en route. We don't really get to see them. So we have to assume that they'll be popping up next week. But it's just the regular crew that we've been dealing with. They're at the funeral. Jubilee, very upset that Rogue isn't there. And at first, it kind of seems like she's upset because she's like, how could she not come? But then it quickly becomes clear that she's actually upset because her not being there means that she's doing something far more dangerous and reckless as a result. And she's concerned for her, as they all are. And then we quickly find out what she's been up to, which is storming federal bases and secret military operations to try to...
Wait. Let's talk about that, but let's stay on the funeral first. What did you think about the funeral?
Well, I mean, if you need to have someone give a eulogy, obviously it's going to be Kurt, right? Nightcrawler is the perfect choice.
How well did he actually know Gambit, though? He seemed to, like, talk about him like they were best friends.
Well, they had a bonding moment in the episode from the original series, and then they had a nice bonding moment in this season where he's all like, Remy, I gotta just go for it. I'm not doing a German accent.
Good. Maybe why.
And so it's kind of implied that they have a relationship prior to what we see, at least, you know. They're doing a lot of broad strokes in defining that. But I think, honestly, if you have a funeral, you just got to go with Nightcrawler, right? He can handle the religious side of things. He can handle the kind of, like, bittersweet, nostalgic, romantic kind of quality that you need from a eulogy.
Yeah,
I guess. I think he delivered.
And he is recently out of a job.
Exactly. And he needs a new place to stay for a while. So he's earning his keep by performing at the funeral. I don't know. Is there someone that you would have rather heard from? Because I feel like, obviously, Rogue isn't there. She would have been the most emotional to deliver that speech, but she wasn't there. And, you know, in the comics, Storm and Gambit have a pretty close relationship. Storm is actually how Gambit ends up on the team originally, but I don't feel like that's really established on the show at all. So I don't know.
No. I mean, I would probably just leave it to the professionals. And I mean, I guess, as you've pointed out, Kurt is a religious professional in some form or other. So maybe it is best to have him. But I was just a bit like, oh, yeah, weird.
Yeah, he's as close to a professional as they can get on the X-Men when it comes to that sort of stuff. So
yeah, I guess.
I guess Beast could have given a pretty decent eulogy, but I feel like he would have kind of made it about him, you know?
There was a funny thing, and it wasn't like... There's a funny thing in the scene where Beast put up his umbrella and suddenly he was blocking more. And I know that it was just like, it wasn't a thing in the next shot. Like it wasn't, he wasn't being, he wasn't blocking more. But it was just this really like funny and just really reinforced all my views about Beast just being like, yeah, I'm putting up my umbrella. Fuck anyone who's behind me. But, yeah,
and also the way that they've been treating poor Morph lately, where Morph has just been getting stuck in the background all the time.
It was funny. But anyway, so the funeral, the other thing I wanted to mention is that Aurora was at the funeral. And this, like, maybe reading too much into this, but remember a few episodes ago, there was a shot of Northstar, who is Aurora's twin brother, yes. Obvi. In the episode when they were in Mojoverse. And so I wonder if these are little Easter eggs leading us up to a Canadian season 2, which means basically that Logan will take center stage.
That would, or maybe, I mean, this show is so popular, maybe a Canadian spinoff.
But Alpha Flight are not popular. So,
well, if you called it X-Men
Canada,
Alpha Flight, maybe it would get numbers. I don't know.
I don't know. But that's what I wanted to ask you. So in the original cartoon, did they do the Weapon X storyline already?
They did, yeah. Logan goes to the compound. He's with like a couple of the other Weapon X characters. He finds out that all of his memories of trauma have been falsified.
Yeah, yeah.
It's kind of all that stuff. So they've definitely, they hit that
beat. It's like, okay. So there's no reason to go back to Canada then?
No. I mean, there's always a reason to go back to Canada, right? There's always some crazy government conspiracy going on up there in the X universe.
maybe, potentially. But anyway, I thought it was interesting that we've seen those two like randomly in the background. And there's no real reason that she would be at Gambit's funeral. Like there's no like, oh, she has to be there.
I can't remember them having, maybe there is an episode of the original series where they're together, but I can't recall it.
So anyway, we'll see how that pans out. Because the other interesting thing is that Wolverine is really underutilized in this show.
Yes.
Even though he's the main character in like every single other adaptation of X-Men.
Yeah. I think, from what I've read about the pitch that Beau DeMeo made to Marvel, that was central in his pitch. He said, like, we have now lived through 20 years of mainstream projects where Wolverine is the synonymous with the X-Men. Wolverine is the main character of the X-Men. And in the comics, especially in the Claremont era, like, that's just simply not true. He's an important character, but very much, you know, one of an ensemble. And then he had his own book for a long time, too, but that was, you know, secondary to what the X-Men were doing. So he's obviously a very popular character, but Beau DeMeo really wanted to created the show in the spirit of the original cartoon, which, you know, had a couple of episodes about Logan here and there, but Logan was not the main character. And I feel like they're kind of leaning into that even more so to just draw that distinction of this is about the X-Men. This is about these characters who are great and fascinating and have incredible mythologies around them. Like, we don't need everything to be connected to Logan.
Yeah. I find it fascinating that they signed off on that.
Yeah. Well, it might be because, I don't know, I don't want to read too much into this, but there's been a lot of theories that a big part of what this show is them sort of soft launching different ideas on what their like mainstream live action version of X-Men will be and trying stuff out here and seeing if the audience goes along with it. And I wouldn't be surprised if part of the calculus was like, will people actually be really excited about an X-Men team where Logan is a character, but not one of the main characters? And I think the answer is yes, as far as I've seen, because this show is way more popular than I expected it to be. How do you feel about that, though? Are you happy with this choice? Because we're deep enough into the season now that it's clear that
Not coming out.
No, he's not getting his own episode for sure at this point. You know, he might factor in prominently in the finale, the three-part finale, but he's definitely not getting a standalone episode in the way that Scott and Jean and Storm have gotten, for instance.
Yeah. I guess one of the things I think is a real missed opportunity is the relationship between Wolverine and Jubilee being explored a bit more.
Yes.
Because I think that that is a really interesting dynamic. I don't want Wolverine to be the main character, but I want him to support Jubilee being featured more.
It's funny. They just made the decision to let Jubilee have one age-appropriate friend, which at the beginning of the season, I was like, that's great. I love that. But then like the downside of it is that now that's the only person who she's allowed to have screen time with, apparently, which is a bummer.
Well, yeah. And the thing about Jubilee is that she's not the mature one. I mean, like she has become the mature one in the comic books, but the whole selling point of Jubilee is that she's the like, you know, wide-eyed ingenue and everyone else is showing her the way. And now she's the one that's like, well, Roberto, this is how you be a mutant. And it's just like, it's not playing to Jubilee's strengths as a character.
Yeah, she's really taking Roberto under her wing and helping him come out of the closet to his parents in a way that just was like extremely, you know, queer coded, especially like, I don't know, like 1992 queer coded, it felt like to me. And I'm curious how all that worked for you. It sounds like already we're off to a rough start because you feel like Jubilee really shouldn't be taking that sort of like elder queer role.
Yeah. Well, I'm not offended by it. And I wasn't watching the episode being like, oh, how dare they or anything. It's just that through talking to you, I'm like, oh, hang on a minute. I think that, yeah, it's fine as a storyline.
Yeah.
I think maybe I'm not the intended target audience. I'm not like the person that needs to hear this, because it did feel a bit like, oh, you're laying it on a bit thick.
It did, yeah. Although that is kind of like the register that this show is in across every aspect of its storytelling in a way, you know. We did have Professor X giving a psychic lecture on jingoism last episode, so... But
I love that he used the word jingoism. Anyway, we're not talking about last week. We're talking about this week.
Never again.
yeah, I thought it was. I thought it was interesting the way that Jubilee was giving advice. But
it seems like this show is very invested in showing her as someone that has matured since we first met her, right? We meet her, she's a young teen, right? She's like 14, 15 years old at the start of X-Men 92. She's written very kind of like kid point of view character, right? And then she has small opportunities to grow over the course of that show, but most of the time she's just in the background being like, but Professor, I want to fly the jet. Like, that's basically her role most of the time. So here she's actually getting to show like all of the benefits of her time with the X-Men to a new person coming along in the role of the young, sort of unsure of where they fit in the world. And I like that idea. I agree with you that like, is that what you want Jubilee to be doing as a character, maybe, maybe not, you know?
Yeah, and because let's not forget that she is only 18. Like, she turned 18 like 3 episodes ago or 4 episodes ago.
Yes.
So she wouldn't, like, I mean, you know, some people would, I guess. But if I was Roberto, I'd be like, what the fuck do you know? Shut up.
Well, he does kind of say that to her in so many words. But it does, I don't know. The show is very invested in using this corner of the show to kind of talk about it in a queer context. I feel like there's other parts of the show where the mutant metaphor gets to be more broad. But I think here it's very specifically a queer metaphor. And I think that it's true to life that someone like a teenager who has only recently, you know, come to terms with their sexuality and started living life openly will immediately turn to the person who is maybe 6 months behind them in that process and be like, oh, honey, baby, child, I have to tell you about the world. That felt very accurate.
Oh, are you speaking from direct experience here?
Maybe. Yeah, definitely. I feel like that is... That is something that I've definitely witnessed and may have been a participant in at some point growing up. So.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. I also thought it was weird that they were like in the middle of Genosha helping like clean up the island, helping find bodies, blah, 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 blah. And then they were like, oh, actually, let's just drop all of this and head off to Brazil.
Yeah.
Like what?
It stretches credulity a little bit from a logistics perspective, if nothing else. But what I like about that is the line that gives Roberto, which is something that felt really true, where she says basically like, you don't want your family to find out who you are after you've been killed. And there's a chance that you're going to be killed. Look at around you, look at what you're seeing, look at what has happened, look at what a danger you were in now more than ever. Like, don't let some random person on the other end of the phone tell your family who you are when you can't have the opportunity to do it yourself. And that is something that I've definitely seen a lot in sort of in like media around the AIDS crisis, especially people who were living closeted lives or openly in cities and closeted with their families who lived elsewhere. When that hit them, when that hit the community really hard, there was that sense of like, I need to come out and now before you get a phone call saying that I'm in the hospital or something worse has happened. And then I never get to explain my story to you. You just have to hear it from a stranger and feel like you never knew me at all. So I thought that was really moving and powerful. But I do think that it's like the show just is, I think this episode is just too full of ideas and like, they should have given you like a whole, we got a whole half episode just about Jubilee, like living inside of a video game. I feel like we could have maybe gotten a little bit more time to tell that story if you wanted to tell it. And if you don't have the time, maybe wait.
Yeah. Yeah. I absolutely agree. But also he could have just FaceTimed his mom. That's all I'm saying.
You don't want to come out over FaceTime because then you don't know if like the lack of reaction is like a Wi-Fi glitch or if you're actually have an hard time.
Yeah, okay, okay. Okay, well, how about this? Like, if it was just vital that Roberto went and spoke to his mother immediately, Jubilee should have stayed behind to help look for bodies.
Yes, I agree with that. I think you can send him off on his own. You really don't have a place to be there. It's nice to be there for support, but, like, you know, you're friends with a psychic and a telepath, right? You can just, like, cast your consciousness over to the apartment if he's in trouble. Like,
I think Jubilee's real motivation here was she was just getting a bit bummed out by life on Genosha at that time. And she was like, how can I convince Roberto to pay for me to go on holiday to Brazil? And that's basically where she was coming
to from. To see his incredible penthouse apartment that he apparently lives in.
Yeah.
But now, what do you think about the reaction that he gets from his mom, where it's like, oh, honey, that's fine. We thought that's what was going on with you and we don't care, but no one can know. It has to be a secret.
Yeah, that's so heartbreaking.
Yeah.
And I think it's one of those things that parents who are not queer don't really understand why that's a problem.
Yeah.
But yeah, heartbreaking.
That's, I think for me, when I saw it play out that way, I was like, this is the benefit of having queer people in the writer's room, because, and Beaudemont is a queer writer. He's leading this story, because the more conventional thing to do is to have the mom be like, oh my God, I can't believe you're gay. You can't be in our family anymore. Right. Have a really big, huge reaction. And certainly that has happened to people. And that's something that unfortunately still does happen to some people. But I think the more common experience is, well, we love you. That's totally fine. This doesn't change anything at all. Don't tell anybody. Like you said, it's really hard for people who are not queer to understand just how awful having the person that you love and to your going to for that support and that validation to say something like that to you.
Mm-hmm. Especially when they don't themselves recognize the disconnect between, I accept you, I love you, but don't tell anyone. Yeah. Like they're opposed to one another, those statements. And I've had conversations with people that just don't get how contradictory it is to say something like that. So yeah, I think it was good that they explored that in the story.
Yeah, and I hope that that's not the last we see of that. I hope that we're going to follow along on that. I wonder if maybe this is building into Bobby kind of coming into his own and having a hero moment late in his arc, where he has to kind of, you know, get away from these pressures that he's feeling about his family and about society and about expectations and acceptance, and just kind of embracing his full power as Sunspot and saving the day as a result. Mm-hmm. I could kind of see it going in that direction.
Yeah, potentially. There definitely is something about him not feeling comfortable using his powers. So I do imagine that by the end of the season, he'll be in a position where he's like, yes, this is who I am, and these are my powers, and I'm going to use them. And then all the other X-Men characters will be like, oh, are you still around? Because he hasn't interacted with anyone other than Jubilee for the last six episodes.
It's like, oh, it was John? No. Jacob? What was it again? But characters who we know their names much better would be, for instance, Scott and Jean. They're having a time of it over in Genosha, trying to clear out some bodies, trying to find survivors. Scott getting the just absolutely infuriating and all too frequent comment by a politician saying, hey, we're just going to be a little bit bigoted towards you and not actually stand up for you, because it's better so we can placate all the people who hate you, instead of, you know, me losing my power and letting someone who hates you even more to power. I'm curious how that scene played with you and how you felt that worked to set up where Scott is for the rest of the episode in dealing with his grief over Madeline.
I hadn't really thought about the interplay between that scene and the rest of the story. I like that they kind of were as open about politicians' motivations in these types of situations and the way that they can kind of spin things so you actually end up thinking that it's somehow your fault. So I did enjoy that interaction. Maybe Cyclops could have been a bit more assertive. That would be my one note.
He was kind of having a temper tantrum, one that I was right there with him on, but he basically hangs up on him.
Yeah, but he was just a bit like, this is this is shit, bye. Like, it didn't really, yeah. You got to play the politician's game.
I think he doesn't fight that hard because he knows that it's a losing battle. And that's not the sort of strategic tactician he is, right? Like, he's a field commander, but he's not in the boardroom making moves, trying to persuade the other side, if you will. And I think that conversation...
But would a field commander hang up?
I guess, he's been going through it, to be fair. His kid was born and died.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, and then came back as a 40-year-old man.
Didn't die.
I mean, he was grieving the loss of his son, who he thought he might never see again.
Yes, yeah.
And then found out that this helps us
understand Professor X's point of view. This is why he didn't leave the school to Scott.
It's true. He's a mess. He can't handle it. He's a glutton for responsibility in all the wrong ways. That's how I would describe Scott Summers.
good, yeah. But let's get on to the more interesting bit.
Yes, I think that it sets up where he is in Genosha in the sense that he's appealing to these allies, these political allies, these humans for help because he is trying to live still by the Professor X example of like togetherness and we all need to come together and be one people, right? And he is let down again by this person and let down by the cynicism of this politician, this idea of like, well, we're not going to stand up for you at your hour of need because it's unpopular, but that's good because that keeps me in a position to help you later on. It's like, well, we need, like, if there was ever a time that we need your help, it's now, you know? And it's like, well, just hang with me for a while. So he's left completely helpless, right? He feels so frustrated and so just like powerless in this grief. And that matches the personal powerlessness that he feels over the loss of Madeline, someone who he still deeply cares about and now never will get the chance to, right? And also this person who was a connection to his son in a way that no one else is. And so I think that he feels incredibly desperate. And I think that conversation at the beginning helps set the stage for that desperation. And I thought we were headed to a place where in that desperation, Jean kind of helps him find a center to move forward within. And I'm curious what you think about their scenes together and if that actually achieved that or not.
Well, first of all, I do love how much you read into these things. and second of all, I much prefer this Jean to the bitchy, like, how dare you think about the woman who you were married to for all this time and had a baby with? I can't believe it. And I think she showed a lot more empathy and just was a bit more realistic about the circumstances in this episode and in these interactions. So I appreciated that.
So I think like I had two reactions. One is like the emotional reaction, which is it's surprising that she's not able to help him in this moment more. It's surprising that they're not like giving him that because that's what I would have expected. Like this show moves so quick through its plot that I would think like, okay, this is a perfect opportunity for them to mend their relationship.
Resolve. You know? Yeah. Okay.
But then like the cynical side of me thinks like, well, if the tension of the season is about Jean and Scott, then that can't get resolved in episode 7. So there's no way that they would do that. I still think it's a brave thing to do to slow walk that, you know, to have these two need time. It respects the wild situation that they found themselves in, right? It would have been very easy to be like, well, this terrible tragedy happened and now we're just gonna, I realize that none of the other stuff matters. They even say something along those lines, but then they actually don't play it that way, right? They still play this distance. They still play this idea that like Scott is rooting in Madeline. But I do think that it shows some growth in Jean, that she's not being petty. She's not being insecure in this moment. She's being respectful of Scott's grief. And she even made this comment of like, well, Storm left. And I kind of liked the idea of having a sister. That I thought was crazy given what we've seen of Jean and how she's been feeling about Madeline.
Yeah. That was fascinating. I think the moment within their scenes together that I really appreciated the most was when Jean sensed a telepath within the rubble, and Scott said, Madeline, like in just like this kind of knee-jerk reaction, like, what if it's Madeline? And you didn't see any kind of jealousy or any tension or anything from Jean. And it was just this kind of like a humanized Scott for me quite a lot. Yeah. And I appreciated that happened.
And then they sit in that feeling, which I think is so brave of a show like this. I understand that it's a quote-unquote kids cartoon that is clearly playing for an adult audience. That's absolutely what's happening. But even still, like, it's pretty brave to put in a scene like that where they sit in the sadness and they don't rush past it and they don't find an easy resolution to it or even like a band-aid over it. He's just feeling horrible. And like the only positive out of that is Jean giving him the space to feel that and Len, she is supporting him in that moment. But that's really dark for an ostensible kids cartoon.
Oh, I have to say, though, I'm so glad, because I would be really angry. The rate at which they resolve things, all the other plot points, like, is getting me like, ah. But the fact that if they were to have written it that all of these ridiculous things have happened to these two humans, but not humans, sorry, to these two mutants, and they... like if they played it in some like our love is so strong that it'll overcome everything, I forgive you, more, let's get move on, I would just be livid. I'd be so angry. So I'm really appreciative that they have kind of just let the grief breathe a little. Although having said all of that, I feel like we didn't really get much of Jean's point of view in this episode.
No, like, because really just by contrast, like
she's I'm not quite sure, like, I know it's not a competition, but like surely they both are in grief and weird feelings. What's the appropriate response when you find out you're a clone?
Yeah, I think that they're choosing to help progress her story, Jean's story, by showing how she is treating Scott, right? That does show movement in where she was in her arc from last episode. And I think that that is an interesting choice, because she does get like that one line of like, oh, now I thought she might be my sister, now I guess not. But like there's an interesting ambivalence to that line reading also, which is kind of funny. So I really think that the way that they're progressing her in this episode is just by showing that like she cares enough about Scott despite everything else that she's going to be here for him, because she knows she can be here for him in a way that no one else can be here for him.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, so now I'm overreading things, so apologies. But it is problematic piece of storytelling, and I'm not necessarily saying that that's what's happening in this instance, but there is a problematic piece of storytelling where the woman is there to help tell the man's story.
Yes.
And that's kind of what it seems to have happened in this episode to me.
Yeah, I think you could definitely read it that way. I think given what we've seen them give her in previous episodes, I think it's fair to...
Other episodes.
Yeah, I think it's fair to give them a little bit of latitude on that and say, like, it's not that she's...
Scott's not interesting enough on his own, y'all.
Well, and also, I mean, you could also say the reverse, where, like, they're letting Scott be the one who's just an absolute emotional wreck, just, like, clinging to emotional attachments, completely incapable of putting his personal problems ahead of this larger mission, right? Which could be coded as female in a more problematic storyline, right? And
but was he like cloned and experimented on and like had his memory wiped? No. So like, yeah, well, it is bad what happened to him, but I would argue that what happened to Jean was worse.
Scott has had his memory wiped at least like 3 or 4 times. So like he at least, that's honestly something they should be bonding over, if nothing else. But I hear what you're saying. I think that something that we've kind of like zoomed past is the Rogue thing. I want to double back around to Rogue, because her storyline in this is like incredible, and we really only touched it briefly.
Oh, do you think so?
Yeah, I loved what they did with her in this episode. I love that they just like totally let her be this like woman wronged, like going around just absolutely destroying shit, trying to get revenge and pushing her to the brink. And it reminded me the fact that she is this character who has a really complicated past. She has this sort of, her morality was not set always, right? She was this person who really went through she was rejected and she was fostered by Mystique and embraced a negative worldview. And then over time was able to find her inner hero. Right. And now she's mm-hmm. had this just absolute debilitating loss, and she doesn't want to necessarily lose the person she's become, but she also is getting pushed to the limit in a way that I think is really interesting. And I think that's the reason why you pair her in this moment with a character like Captain America, who is this like pillar of upstanding values and whatever, right? Because it gives you this strong contrast of like, she's doesn't care about any of that nonsense. She wants like revenge because of this she wants justice in her head. She thinks it's justice, yeah, but yeah. it's also revenge, right? And that gives her that moment towards the end of the episode where she lets him die, lets Trask die when he no longer can help her because of everything he took from her. I think the whole arc in this episode is really interesting.
Yes.
And right in the middle of it is that incredible scene between her and Nightcrawler where she really lets herself grieve even just for a moment and has that support.
Yeah. I think it was important to take the story forward, but I don't think there was anything particularly like unexpected. And so I understand that we have to have this as part of the storyline because we need to understand how Rogue responds. But I wasn't like, oh yeah. I was just like, yeah.
There was no like, you weren't feeling any catharsis for the loss of Gambit by seeing her rage against Thunderbolt Ross, for instance.
No, not really. And I feel like Captain America was really weirdly used in this episode as well. So maybe there was some of that for me where it was like, okay. Why is this interaction happening? What's going on?
Yeah. Well, I think it's, I said why I think it's happening. Like you don't buy that theory of like wanting to juxtapose her, like all emotion, all rage response with the sort of like moral pillar of justice that he represents.
Well, was he representing moral justice or was he representing computer says no culture? Like this kind of this system.
Yeah, he's representing the system, right? He's like a Boy Scout in this sense. But I do think that like there is like that's it's coded in complicated ways, right? Where it's like he's there, but he's not the sort of hero that Rogue needs right now, or the sort of hero that Rogue could be right now, because he is maybe arguably too concerned about the idealism of what it means to be Captain America in this moment.
Yes, and she
just is like, people are dying and we need to stop that from happening. And if I am going to get revenge out of that, that's fine. But I have a moral cause and I'm just in my pursuit. And also I'm mad as hell and I'm not afraid to take it out on the people who I think are at fault.
Yes, yes. But if you think about the reason that Captain America was there.
He was there to like to pursue Trask just the same as her, but
oh, so not to stop her.
No, like she initially thinks that he is there to stop her, and he says, "Oh no, like I'm on the same case that you are. I've been investigating them too.
I don't buy it. I don't buy it.
I do. I think it makes sense. But I think that it's a good use of the Avengers in general and Steve in particular, because it's this idea of why whenever the mutants are in danger, do the Avengers not come and help? Why is there this split in the Marvel mm-hmm. universe? And like the real reason is because like the Avengers are in the Avengers books and the mutants are in the mutant books, right? But if you accept it as like a working universe, why is that the case? And part of it is because like the mutants have to protect themselves because they are at such risk that they can't concern themselves with these like high-minded pursuits of valor and idealism to protect their family, right? It's a lot more of an emotional place to be because their situation is so much more dire and desperate in a lot of ways, especially in this moment. So I feel like that's where that contrast is. And yeah. I feel like we're supposed to be with her when he says, but my hands are tied here. And she says, well, if your hands are tied, then you won't be needing this. And she throws his shield as far as she possibly can, which is an excellent moment that I liked a lot, right? We're supposed to feel frustrated in that moment that he's representing a system that isn't helping in a similar way to the way that the politician is representing a system that isn't helping them, right? Everyone is letting them down.
Yes. The reason that it seemed a bit weird is because I just don't think Captain America would just be like, Suz, can't help you.
Well, I certainly don't think that like the Steve Rogers of the MCU would do that, because he is very much, you know, the surest hands are our own from Civil War. He's the whole thing that happens in Civil War is like he doesn't want to take government orders because he's an American, right? He's not going to listen to anybody. But I know that in other stories, especially in the comics, he's oftentimes presented in a similar way he's presented here versus the, I think, more fan-friendly version that we get with Chris Evans in the role.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think like if we pursue this conversation anymore, we're going to get into this murkiness of like, why do like regular human beings in the Marvel universe accept the Avengers but not the X-Men? Like, it's okay to get your power if you got bitten by a spider, but not if you were born with it? Anyway.
Yeah, although the people of the Marvel Universe don't accept Spider-Man either, to be fair. They oftentimes don't, so.
Oh, okay. But now that he's an Avenger, he's okay, I think.
I guess it depends.
Haven't people like, gotten with the program?
You know, the thing about Spider-Man comics, my understanding is that they keep progressing things and then resetting back to zero, so.
Oh, yeah.
So I don't know about that, but I do think that it's interesting that they're choosing to play with that at all. And I think it's well used. I respect the fact you feel differently. I'm curious, though, did the scene with Nightcrawler not work for you then?
It was fine. I'm not complaining. I know I sound like I am, because that's just like the way I am. But it wasn't unexpected, right? Like, that's how you would, in many TV shows, resolve someone's grief, like having that moment of breaking down.
That's true. So it felt a little formulaic to you.
Yeah.
Did it feel formulaic to you to have Rogue murder Trask in cold blood and then have him turn into a flying cyborg?
Yeah, I mean, I saw that coming like 10 miles away. Come on. No. I wasn't expecting that. The whole thing felt very strange, that scene. And I can't tell you why I think it felt strange.
Well, it also is animated incredibly. I think it looks so good in the sense that there's
Because of the shadows and the light. Is that what you're talking about?
Exactly. Yeah, and it matches the mood so well of this kind of like, they're really, if we're inside Rogue's mind at this point, she's in such a dark emotional place where she's just like on the edge of the be still holding on to that hero ideal, and you've got this kind of like dark, you know, super cool cityscape with the flashing lights, like you said, and then especially after the explosion, I thought it looked great, very evocative.
Did we get enough insight into how other people felt when Rogue murdered Bolivar?
You get a kind of quick like round robin of reaction. It's very fast because they just are like running out of time in the episode. But it basically, some people seem a little
bit. Let's signal this is wrong.
Exactly. Some people are a little scandalized that she did it. Nobody tried to stop her, and they absolutely could have. I think that's notable. But they let Wolverine kind of have the last word on it, which is like, she did the thing that we all wanted to do and were too afraid to, which is like interesting use of Wolverine, because that feels in character. And I think it interestingly speaks to where the whole team is at, that nobody challenges that. They let that kind of sit as the last word, because you could imagine a situation where many people in that room would have challenged that and said, no, like, we're better than that. Like, that's not, I wouldn't have wanted that. That's not who we are. And nobody challenges it because they're all grieving this horrible, this is a man who they view as responsible for genocide, right? Like, they're not in the moment to be like, well, we need to respect our high-minded pursuits of idealism and morality, right? And I think that's pretty interesting and a good use of Logan.
Yes. And realistically, they've not slept for the last 72 hours.
They've just been on that plane too. But then we get the big fight with the Prime Sentinel. Are Prime Sentinels as a villain force in X-Men comics something that you're interested in? Is this something that you're like, oh, I've always wanted to see this, I'm so excited? Or is this new to you? Or
no, I think Sentinels are just like the dumbest thing ever. Because if you were going to make a killing machine, why would you make it like a human shape? Like, it just doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah, but the Prime Sentinels are like upping the ante because they're actually just turning humans into Sentinels.
Well, yes. Sorry. So basically, I like check out whenever Sentinels get talked about, because I'm just like, this just makes no sense. Like, why would you do this? But Prime Sentinels, very interesting adaptation of the technology in order to be more effective in the killing. I don't know enough about this. Like, are they always triggered by someone's death?
No. I mean, in the comics, this is like a big Operation Zero Tolerance. Like, in the comics, that's like a whole arc that this is definitely getting inspiration from, but they're making a lot of deviations as well to fit it into other stuff. But my memory of the comics with the Prime Sentinels is that they could basically be activated remotely at any point by the people who want them to be. And many of the people were kidnapped and had this done to them. Some people don't even know that they're Prime Sentinels. And then all of a sudden, like, they just get activated. And it's usually just like for whatever the comic book wants them to be activated by, you know, like, it's very plot convenient. So here it was thematically resonant. But in other cases, it could just be like Sinister presses a button and no, they're all, you know, Prime Sentinels activated. But I think it's kind of cool from like a sort of like Invasion of the Body Snatchers kind of way, Insidious. It also, there's like a metaphor there about how, like, you know, humans bigoted, hate mutants. They become these monstrous people as a result by becoming Prime Sentinels, right? Like, you could read into it if you want. There's some symbolism there. But I think also it was like the 90s and they're like, Terminators are pretty cool. What if we did that instead of big giant purple things? So I think there's a little bit of that too.
Yeah, maybe. They need to be a bit sleeker. Yeah. They need to be a bit more subtle as well. Like, those Sentinels, you can tell they're coming from miles away, right?
Okay, so that's kind of the episode. We talked about pretty much everything. We didn't talk about Beast. Beast gets like a moment where Trish Tilby comes.
Oh, no, we
haven't.
Do you
want to talk about that?
Oh, yes. I want to talk about that. I liked that because, you know, there's this relationship between Trish and Beast, and they've, you know, got this little like thing going on. But it was good for Beast to be like, no, actually, I need to put you in your place. Stop thinking that, like, that we have anything to do with what's happened. Please just fuck off now.
I didn't dislike it. I just kind of feel like I don't trust it coming from Beast, you know? It's like, I like that he tried to put her in her place a little bit, but it's like, you're gonna... You have too much self-hatred inside to stick to this hard moral line of, like, I don't care about your tolerance. Like, I think his line was something like, I'm sorry that I've taken up enough of your tolerance for today, or something like that, which was a killer line, but I just don't buy it coming from Beast. We all know Beast. He's too much of a company man.
Oh, no, I don't know. I mean, it depends with this Beast, right? Because in the comic books, Beast has continually gotten more and more evil.
That's true.
So I kind of hate the comic book Beast. But in the animated series, he is quite moralistic. Because there's that whole storyline in the original series about him going to jail and then refusing to break out and stuff, right?
Yes, that's true. Maybe I'm just a little resentful of him because of the whole Nicholas Holt portrayal, where he is just the biggest wet blanket that ever existed.
Okay, so let's not focus on Beast then. I quite enjoyed that moment. I also like that they have Trish Tilby in there, just because I just think, like, it's such a, like, throwback to the 80s when Beast was in X Factor. But anyway, the other things that I wanted to talk about was the elephant in the room, right? How is it that none of the mutants that were there in Genosha to do the cleanup had powers that were useful?
Well, because the useful ones all died.
But surely there was some mutant somewhere in the world that was like, do you know what? I can, like, well, even Jean was there. Why wouldn't she just be like, I'm going to use telekinesis to pick up all these things and then see if there's any bodies underneath. And if there aren't, then I'll put it back down.
It's true. She was not very helpful, but she was doing a lot of emotional labor for Scott.
Of course. But, like, where are your priorities, Jean? Where are your priorities? Anyway, so there's that. And, you know, even someone who can see through things, surely there's someone who can see through things.
That's true. I mean, yeah, lots of people can see through things in the X world, right? That's a pretty common...
Yeah.
Yeah.
And see, if we had Kitty Pryde, she could have just walked through all the rubble and, like, pulled bodies out.
Well, maybe that's why she's not here, because she just is too useful in that situation.
And so the other things I wanted to point out were Strong Guy was a cameo in this episode. Yes. Actually, I think he had a line.
He did, yeah.
Morph turned into Quicksilver.
And became super fast.
Every time Morph turns into anyone, I'm like, oh, hang on, what? And then I realize it's Morph.
I know. I feel the same way. A lot of people, I feel like, have that same moment every single time. We're seven episodes of ranting every time.
And it's still like, when did this person join the team? Oh, okay.
They almost never show morphing into the person. They just cut to, oh, it's this person. It's like, just show Morph turning into Quicksilver. And then we would all not be. None of us would be disoriented.
Oh, but I quite like it, though, because it's like, oh, hang on. Did I just stop paying attention? Oh, no. This is just a random thing. It helps jolt me back into the TV show. The other spoken part that was in this episode was Amelia, who is a mutant but doesn't have a mutant name. I'm not really sure why. Maybe she was like, nah, man, that's not for me.
But Amelia, I thought that was a pretty cool name. So
yeah, but it's not like Storm, Rogue, Cyclops. It's like Amelia. But she's a pretty obscure character from the 90s. So interesting that she was in there, I just think. I don't think it's going to necessarily lead to anything. It's probably just like a, hey, geeks, here you go. But interesting that she had quite a few lines. And then the other thing that we haven't talked about is Emma Frost.
Yes. So you got your moment. You told us this was going to happen last week, and it did.
Yes.
She is rescued, and she is rescued while in her diamond form, and Beast helpfully lets the audience know that in this continuity, she has never been in a diamond form before, even though in a lot of other times, if you've seen her, you know that she has a diamond form. But canonically, that's true. I just thought it was very funny the way that happened.
But Genosha was the trigger for this secondary mutation in the comic books as well.
Yes, and so that honors that, which is great. But I feel like most people, if you've seen that character in any of like the live action media or even in some of the other cartoons, like they lean on that diamond form a lot.
Yes.
So in this, so it really felt like Beast just being like, hey guys, just so you know, in our universe, this has never happened before.
Oh, yeah, I hadn't thought about it that way. I loved and hated in equal amounts her follow-up line, which was, I've always done well under pressure.
Yes, that was classic.
But yeah, it's interesting, and I don't know whether she's going to feature elsewhere in the series or if they were just like, oh, we better cover this now in case we need to use her later, because it was just this like, oh, we found her. Okay, now she's buggering off. And that's it. And I know it helped also to propel the Jean and Scott storyline because he thought it was Madeline for a split second. But it just felt a very like, oh, that was it. We're not going to like spend any more time with Emma. She's just buggering
on. But it's important because she looked extremely dead when we last saw her. So it's important that we at least know that she's going to still be around.
Yeah, I guess. But unless they don't use her, in which case it's like, well, why did you tell us this? Because we could always find out in series three that she actually survived, right?
I think that you needed that moment because Scott earlier was like, you have to help us find survivors. And the politician was like, look, dude, there's probably no survivors. And even if there were, we're not going to help you. And so the fact that they found one more person, I think, validates that idea that Scott was right and that the politician should have stuck around and helped, you know, that callousness would have cost us Emma's life.
Yeah. I guess the other sad thing about that was when Cyclops was trying to bargain by being like, Valerie Cooper was there. She's a human. Don't you want to save her?
Yeah. Now, the last thing that we should talk about very briefly is like the end of the episode where we got this big villain reveal.
Oh, yeah.
Just kind of important. Now, the show doesn't explicitly say who this person is, but people who know the character know. We find out that it's that Mr. Sinister, as he often is actually working for someone else. Although I'm sure he has his own plan in the background where he's going to be revealing that he's actually been using him all along. But in any case, that's fun. I'm excited for that to happen. And in the meantime, we got Bastion. He's here. He's leading the this Prime Sentinels
OCT.
Now. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's a big part of the OCT story in the comic books. I'll be honest, I did not retain a lot of Bastion information when it was covered in the comic books as I was going through it originally.
Oh no. Did neither of us have anything to say about Bastion?
I remember like he has a sort of twisted origin story that I'm sure will get revealed. It's they were already sort of hinting at it with the whole like Nimrod like flashes that we saw, things like that. But Yeah, I don't know. I always thought this.
He's got a dumb name.
Yeah, he does. Bastion. Like, what is, like, they were really not trying that day. They're like, I don't know. We got to just put something on the page. We'll fix it later. So they have Magneto. They're shaving him mm-hmm. for some reason. What is that about?
Really? And opening up his pores.
Yes.
Yeah.
And they're like, you like, were they born were
being
for this.
Very, very thoughtful. Yeah.
So what do you make of that? Like, what do you think about the fact that, like, it's Mr. Sinister and now we get a reveal immediately the next week being like, it's not Mr. Sinister.
I don't feel either way. Right now, I need to wait for it to like pay off in order to form my opinion. You know how I am. I'm like a bit too ambivalent yes. about these things. I think I wish that they just kind of would tell us what it is rather than having that as the cliffhanger for 2 weeks in a row.
Yeah. I like that at least they let them talk to each other. It's not just like a visual reveal. Like we at least get a scene of them together, but where it's all like cryptic and it's like, ooh, what's going to happen? But yeah, I don't know. I want more. I need more at this point.
Mm-hmm. But and also we need to find out what happened to the mutants that were in the vicinity of Magneto when we thought he died. That's what I want to know. Is Leech somehow alive?
Yes, I feel the same way. Okay, so that's that. That's the tease.
Oh, that's something that we didn't talk about was Cable and the interaction.
Yeah.
Do we care?
Where Jean is like, oh, it's Nathan. And then like, he's like, what? It's Nathan. Hi. And he's like, yeah, hi dad. Now let's get back to work. It was like, I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was kind of like
bang, 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 bang.
It was what if I have to say one thing that I liked about that moment, it was that like Jean communicates with him telepathically for a moment. And he does respond telepathically back to her, telling her to get out of my head. You're not her. Meaning Madeline, meaning you're not my real mom, which was like, love Cable, who's this big, gruff, macho guy being like, you're not my real mom. Like, okay, calm down. So I liked that moment. That felt messy in a perfectly Summers family way. But yeah, I'm surprised they didn't make more of it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Just like he just keeps coming in for like little snippets of episodes and then buggering off and you don't really get any sense of anything. What are your views on the next 3 weeks then? Do you think that we will be getting the show wrapped up in a bow by the end of episode 10?
I hope that we resolve this arc, and like any good soap opera, the resolution of this arc propels us into a new arc with a lot of fun potential. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's what I'm hoping for. I don't want the finale to end on a cliffhanger tied to this arc, but I would like it to end on a place where we're like, oh, now what? Like, you know, and sort of my favorite. I watch a lot of soap operas growing up, and the best soap opera plots are the ones where every resolution opens a door to a better, more interesting storyline that feeds off of the first, where you feel like there's a resolution, but you're getting that propulsion to a new story that's also exciting. That's what I'm hoping for.
And for season two, is your money still on Age of Apocalypse?
Yeah, I think that they have to play that. I think they have to do it. Because they didn't do it in the original, mostly because they did a story in the original series, which then was the inspiration for Age of Apocalypse in the comics. So they didn't actually get to do that. There's like that whole storyline where like there's like this weird time quake, and then all of a sudden like Wolverine and Storm are like this like brooding romantic couple in the future who have to go into the past to save Professor X from being killed as a college student, and it's like this two-part episode with Bishop and stuff, and that was such a successful storyline that they were a story where like, what if someone travels back in time and kills Professor X, like what happens? And then that's how
fascinating.
So I think that's why they never touched it really in the original run, but I think why not now? There's no reason not to.
Yeah. So my money for season two is Avengers versus X-Men.
Okay, I could see it. Clearly whatever season two is going to be, like, they built season one with the like knowing that they were building towards a season two.
Yes.
So
yeah.
It would have to be informed with something that we're seeing here,
which is Captain America being a douchebag.
I just don't know if they dropped the line that like the bunker is for the Hulk, so the Hulk exists in this universe. We already know Spider-Man exists in this universe from the original cartoon, having crossover with the Spider-Man cartoon. Mm-hmm. And there's people on the board. I could see it. I don't know if they would want to go that deep into Avengers stuff with this X property, but it would be interesting. But speaking of surprising things, I have a little treat for you guys at the end of this episode, because this is, of course, the week that the Tortured Poets Department has been released by Taylor Swift. And I decided, you know, that was a double album release. For people who don't know, she released 31 songs, and that meant that there's enough songs that we could pair every single X-Men in this show with their very own Taylor Swift song just from this album. So I've done all of the work, and I didn't let Kay know this was happening in advance, so he's going to hear all of this for the first time.
No.
And he hasn't heard the album, so it's going to be a fun little mini segment. But I'm going to kick it off with Rogue.
I'll make appreciative noises. Ooh.
I'm going to kick it off with Rogue, who was the star of this episode, as far as I'm concerned. And this really channels where she is right now. It's a song called Who's Afraid of Little Old Me? The reason why I picked it for her is because of this little part of the episode. And I really encourage everyone to listen to all these songs, obviously, on Spotify or Apple Music, wherever you get your music. But I'll just give you a little brief window into my thinking. There's this stanza that goes, "So I leap from the gallows and levitate down your street, crash the party like a record scratch as I scream, who's afraid of little old me? I was tame, I was gentle, to the circus life made me mean. Don't you fuck out all her teeth, who's afraid of little old me?" So that really spoke to me as Rogue in this moment, right? I'm curious what you think about that.
Yeah.
Do you see it? Do you see the vision?
I see it. I get it. Yes. I think that definitely chimes with the behavior that was exhibited by Rogue in this episode.
Thank you so much.
Now, Jubilee. Jubilee, now, what was the Jubilee song?
Okay, so Jubilee,
Am I messing up your order?
No, it's okay. We can go straight to Jubilee. I was a little bit lazy with her. I paired her with Roberto, as the show compulsively does. And I picked the song So High School, which is a song that Taylor Swift wrote about her current relationship with Travis Kelce. And it's just basically about how, her relationship makes her feel like she's in high school again. And so I felt like, what better choice than to pick our teens?
Wait. So Jubilee didn't get her own song. Jubilee had to share a song with Roberto.
She had to share a song with Roberto because she has had to share every single scene with Roberto. So it felt only just. And I was just thinking listen to these lyrics and you'll get it, I think, more. She says, "Touch me while your bros play Grand Theft Auto. Shouts honor. You knew what you wanted and boy, you got her." So that kind of made me feel a little bit like Roberto and Jubilee, right? With the video game connection and
video game, yes,
the innocence of innocence of youth. Good song. Now there is a song for Professor X. I wanted to give him respect, even though he's not technically in this episode. We now know he is coming back as part of the team, and so I gave him a song that informs where he is right now. His big arc is with Lalandra, right? The love arc that they had and how they just broke up. And so, of course, we're going to go with Down Bad. And the lyrics that made me think of Down Bad are, "Did you really beam me up in a cloud of sparkling dust just to do experiments on? Tell me I was your chosen one. Showed me that this world is bigger than us, then sent me back to where I came from." I mean, is that not about Lalandra and Professor X?
Yeah. She ejected him from her planet. he left willingly. Sorry.
Well, but like, he left to go be with his family, but she was like, you know, if you leave, you can never come back.
Yeah, but can you imagine how much it costs to travel that far?
Does it cost that much?
I mean, it must, right?
Maybe.
I've never traveled that far, but I'm assuming. Okay. All right, next X-Men.
So my next X-Men is Wolverine, and it's all about his unrequited love for Jean, of course. It's a song called Guilty as Sin, ? That's the name of the song, Guilty as Sin with a question mark. And I'm thinking of it mostly because this is a little bit longer, but I have to kind of give you all of it, right? So it's, "My boredom's bone deep. This cage was once just fine. Am I allowed to cry? I dream of cracking locks, throwing my life to the wolves or the ocean rocks, crashing into him tonight. He's a paradox. I'm seeing visions. Am I bad or mad or wise? What if he's written mine on my upper thigh? Only in my mind, one slip and falling back into the hedge maze. Oh, what a way to die." So, thoughts on that?
Yes, written on my thigh.
Yeah, written mine on my upper thigh, right? That's he's thinking about Gene.
Oh, written mine. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Would he do it with his claws? It. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. That would be, I mean, if he didn't do it too deep, it would be pretty intense. I mean, this is, we're getting a little X-rated. Oh, boy. Okay. Next. Next is an easy one. I'm going with Magneto, and it's Magneto, but like in Charles Xavier's voice. It's a song called I Can Fix Him by Taylor Swift. Made me think of it because of a stanza that goes, they shake their heads saying, God help her, when I tell him he's my man. But your good Lord doesn't need to lift a finger. I can fix him. No, really, I can. And only I can. And if that's not Professor Xavier and Magneto's relationship, I don't know what is.
Yes. Yes. Okay. But who's fixing who?
Oh, I mean, that's, well, that's the rub, right? They both think that they're fixing each other. And that's why they have incredible chemistry.
But Magneto was right.
Yeah. Now we're moving on to Jean and Scott. And I honestly, I don't think I can even pick a single part of this song because like all of it just feels very Jean and Scott to me. It's a song called either Love of My Life or Loss of My Life. And it's about the falling in and out of love in a epic way.
So deep.
But one of the lines that made me think of them goes, who's going to stop us from waltzing back into rekindled flames? If we know the steps anyway, we embroidered the memories of the time I was away. Stitching, we were just kids, babe. I said, I don't mind. It takes time. I thought it was better safe than starry-eyed. I felt a glow like this, never before and never since. I mean, is that not their relationship?
I mean, yeah, but aren't lots of Taylor Swift songs like that?
But this one is like all about like reconnecting and being star. I mean, okay. It really spoke to me as the Gene and Scott song. So they also had to share a song, but it's because, you know, their relationship is so
At this okay. point in the show. So there was no song called Bright Eyes.
No. No, unfortunately not. Okay, now this one is for our beloved and dearly departed Gambit. Mm. And it's a song called I Can Do. And lyrics made me think of it because I'm thinking of like where Gambit has been all season prior to dying, which is like seeing his beloved Rogue cheat on him, leave him for Magneto, just absolutely wreck him, right? So it goes, I'm so depressed, I act like it's my birthday every day. I'm so obsessed with him, but he avoids me like the plague. I cry a lot, but I am so productive. It's an art. You know you're good when you can even do it with a broken heart. And he did. He saved Genosha with a broken heart.
Yeah. Oh, well, did he have a broken heart by that point?
Yeah, of course. She had just rejected him.
Oh, okay. Oh, and
he said that he would always be her friend.
I think he knew, though.
He was absolutely heartbroken.
I think he knew that she was coming back.
Well, we'll never know because he died.
Yeah, yeah.
And he will stay dead forever, as all X-Men do. But I did also, like, what you don't know is that that song has, like, a very kind of, like, upbeat, like, poppy, like, synthy quality to it. And so I did think that it kind of captures a little bit of the kind of, like, wounded, but, like, I'm going to put on a false bravado essence of Gambit throughout this season.
Like a false bravado, like a midriff bearing t-shirt.
Okay. So now we're gonna move on to Storm. Now her song is all about her relationship with Forge, which is very messy, right? And it's gonna go with I'm gonna get you back. And if you didn't know, that's written in all undercase letters and all one giant big word because Miss Taylor was really on something. And the lyric that made me think of her was, small talk, big love, act like I don't care what you did. I'm an Aston Martin that you steered straight into the ditch, then ran and hid. And I'll tell you one thing, honey, I can take the upper hand and touch your body, flip the script and leave you like a dumb house party, or I might just love you till the end. And that kind of feels like where Storm is, and where she can't really decide. And the chorus, chorus goes, whether I'm going to be your wife or going to smash up your bike, I haven't decided yet. But I'm going to get you back. Whether I'm going to flip you off or pull you into the closet, I haven't decided yet. but I'm going to get you back. And that's kind of where Storm is with Forge, for reasons that we don't.
I thought
totally,
she'd forgiven
well,
him.
Well, now she's
I thought she'd forgiven him.
But like in terms of where she is throughout the season, like that's sort of the conflict that she has with Forge, right?
Okay.
She slaps him, but then she heals him, right? So.
And then she ruins his ceiling. Yeah. So Nightcrawler.
Yes. Okay. We can go to Nightcrawler next. So Nightcrawler. It was a little tough to find a Nightcrawler, but I went with the Prophecy, and I'm thinking about his relationship with Genosha. He seemed really happy to be there, right? And now look what's happened. He's been cast out again. So that makes me think of these lyrics where it goes, "Hand on the throttle, thought I caught lightning in a bottle. Oh, but it's gone again. And it was written, I got cursed like Eve got bitten. Oh, was it punishment? Pat around when I get home. I guess I hope a greater woman wouldn't beg, but I looked to the sky and said," and then there's the chorus. So that made me feel like, you know, the kind of, you know, complicated feelings he has. He really was so excited to be there. He's been cast out before. He thought he found home. And now, just like Eve, it seems like maybe he's been cursed. And is this punishment? Because he is a Catholic. He's like very religious. So he's got that sense of like, maybe I'm the reason for all of this, right? And he hasn't lost hope, but he also is looking to the sky and wondering why.
Taking freelance gigs at friends' funerals. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. You think he got paid for that?
Don't you get paid? I don't know.
To do a eulogy at a funeral? Not usually.
Yeah, but he like conducted the whole thing.
Well, that's true. But I think when a friend does that,
it wasn't just
like
one speech. Well, I don't know. And this is the thing, like, I don't think that they really were friends. I think that Nightcrawler was just like there for the check.
Yeah. Well, I guess that's where we disagree. Moving on to the next song. It's your friend Morph. And I don't think you're going to like this, but aww. I went with a song called I Look in People's Windows. And it's all about Taylor being a bit of a voyeur looking for her lost love in people's homes, like a creep. And that kind of feels like Morph in a sense, because it's like Morph like lives kind of in the background, taking on other people's personas, other people's powers, right?
I thought you were going to say it because if you had Morph's powers, that's what you would do.
Well, yeah. Well, if you had Morph's powers, you could also just like walk into people's homes, be like, I live here, you know, see what happens. But I feel like Morph has to observe these people who they are becoming, right? That it has to, in order for the power to work. So that's the sort of voyeuristic sense. But the chorus or the stanza that made me really think of him was a sort of, so I look in people's windows like I'm some deranged weirdo. I attend Christmas parties from outside. I look in people's windows in case you're at their table. What if your eyes looked up and met mine one more time? And of course, Morph is talking about Wolverine. We all know this.
Of course. Yeah. No, I don't know. Yeah. You know how I feel about being sexually attracted to Wolverine.
I know. It's complicated for you. okay. And the last member of the X team that we have to talk about today is, of course, Beast. And I went with the Tortured Poets department. And I thought of it in a number of reasons. It's a lot about like these kind of like sophisticated references and kind of things like that that I felt like maybe he would have made. But I'm imagining this is Taylor or someone else, maybe Trish Tilby even, singing to Beast about his experience and thinking about lines like, you smoked, then ate 7 bars of chocolate. We declared Charlie Poof should be a bigger artist. I scratch your head, you fall asleep like a tattooed golden retriever, but you awaken with dread, pounding nails in your head. But I've read this one where you come undone. I choose this cyclone with you. And who's going to hold me like you? And who's going to know you like me? I laughed in your face and said, you're not Dylan Thomas. I'm not Patti Smith. This ain't the Chelsea Hotel. We're modern idiots. I don't know. That felt like a scene that could have happened in Beast's life.
So Trish is...
like he's quoting Dylan Thomas. She's stroking his head like he's a golden retriever. It makes sense to me.
Okay,
I don't know.
Okay. But so this is Trish saying this to Beast.
Yes, exactly. And like he's got this self-hatred in him, right? We know this from his origins, right? He turned himself blue. Mm. He's trying to cure himself, right? He goes through all these complicated things about like, do I own who I am? Do I hide? So I feel like there's darkness in that soul.
But Charlie Puth shouldn't be a bigger artist.
But I could see Trish Tilby telling Beast that she thinks that he should be.
Yeah, maybe. Okay.
Okay, and so...
But just so we're clear.
Yes.
That's a no.
I'm honestly ambivalent towards Charlie Puth, but I had a feeling that you would not appreciate that sentiment.
Yeah, it's a weird line. I wonder how that's going to date. Anyway.
I have one bonus track because, of course, it's a Taylor album, so we have to honor the bonus track spirit. And I'm going to say this is a song that Madeline Pryor, in her Goblin Queen mode, is singing about Mr. Sinister, okay? It's called My Boy Only Breaks His Favorite Toys, and it goes a little something like this. Oh, here we go again. The voice is in his head, called the rain to end our days of wild. The sickest army doll, purchased at the mall. Rivets descend my plastic smile, but you should have seen him when he first got me. My boy only breaks his favorite toys. I'm queen of Sandcastle, he destroys. Cause it fit two rough pieces instead of night. Should have known it was a matter of time. Oh, my boy only breaks his favorite toys. So that's Goblin Queen Madeline Pryor as singing about Sinister.
So roughly what percentage of Taylor Swift songs are about boys that she thinks she can fix?
Like 87%. I mean, part of, like, you have to split it in half. Okay. Some of them are about boys who she currently thinks she can fix, and the other half are about boys who she realizes now that she can't fix.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. But there are also, like, I mean, in her Evermore era that she had, right? She has a lot of songs about how she's actually the one that's fucked up and needs help. So, and that actually is what made me like her. So there's at least that. There's some balance. Oh. Yeah.
So how did she go back to,
Well, then she broke up with that boy who made her feel like she was the problem. Remember the song, Hi, I'm the Problem, Me, that's an era. And then she started dating Maddie Healy, who made her feel very confident that she was not the problem. And now she's with Travis Kelce, and we'll all have to see how that goes. But I have definitely spoken about this for far too long. I hope that was fun for people. I had a blast. I hope you did too. Until next time, Kay. Where can you find your stuff on the internet?
Lost Spaces Pod across most platforms that you peruse, but especially on Instagram and TikTok. And I have a podcast called Lost Spaces, which is about people's firsthand memories of being in lost queer spaces and what they meant to them. And you can find that wherever you find podcasts. Alex, where can people find you?
You can follow me on Letterboxd at Media Thinkings. You can follow me on Blue Sky at Alex Marcus. You could go to thepopbreak.com, click on the podcast tab, see all the podcasts that I supervise as a podcast director, including the two that I host, in addition to this one, which is TV Break, which is coming back next week for a May episode. We're going to be talking about Dead Boy Detectives, that Dead Boy Detective Agency adaptation that Netflix is doing. So if you're a comic book fan, you might enjoy listening to our thoughts on that. And also, as comic book fans, you would enjoy Bill versus the MCU, where me and Bill Botkin talk about the latest Marvel rewatch that we're up to. Right now, we're doing the X-Men franchise. We have gotten through quite a number of them in the last few months. We did the original trilogy. We did the prequel trilogy. We did New Mutants and Dark Phoenix. Now, this coming month, we are going to be doing the Wolverine trilogy, which is a trilogy only because there are three movies starring Wolverine. They seem to all take place in completely different continuities, have nothing to do with each other, really. But I can't wait to talk about them. We haven't recorded that yet. But as we always do, Kay... This is now your opportunity to ask me one question about the Fox X universe.
Well, I have a clarifying question. Does that have to count as my question?
No, we don't need to do genie rules. You're allowed to ask more than one.
Okay. So my clarifying question, so there's Wolverine, so the terrible first Wolverine that had this weird version of Deadpool in it. And then there's the like old man Wolverine with X-23 in it. What's the other one?
So the three movies are X-Men Origins Wolverine, which is the first one, which is the prequel. Then there's The Wolverine, which takes place shortly after X3, The Last Stand. And it's all about Wolverine going to Japan to honor a former associate who he knew during World War II. And he gets roped up in a whole bunch of Japanese shenanigans, as Wolverine in the comics often did. mm-hmm. And then there's Logan, which is the one that you were thinking of. That's the X-23 Old Man Logan sort of story. So they are three movies that truly have nothing to do with each other. And that's part of the fun.
Well, then, so my question is, which of those three did you prefer? Oh, it's probably got an obvious answer, right?
I haven't done the rewatch yet. And this is actually, this episode will feature the only time that I'm watching a movie for this podcast that is a first watch, because I've never seen X-Men Origins Wolverine, because that movie was supposed to be.
You are in for a treat.
I am.
You are in for a real treat.
I can't wait. Maybe I should ask you a question about that movie. All I really know about it is that Troy Sivan plays Wolverine in flashbacks.
Oh, really? Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah. Oh, how interesting.
Little baby, 12-year-old Troy Sivan.
I remember, yeah, I've only ever seen it once and just being like, what the fuck is going on? Because Gambit is in that film as well. They just do bad by everyone, really. They do a really bad Gambit. Yeah. They do a really bad Deadpool. Yeah.
Nobody gets out alive on that one, unfortunately, from what I've heard. So can't wait to check that out. You will hear what I think.
Brilliant.
All right. Well, that's going to do it for us. This ended up being a bonus-sized episode, but we had to do a solid 30 minutes on Taylor Swift. Obviously, as an X-Men podcast, we had no choice. The once and future Dazzler, Miss Swift. Can't wait to see that when it happens. But until then, we'll see you next week with part one of the three-part finale of X-Men 97 season 1.
Near the end, guys.